Welcome to the Quentin Crisp Memorial Celebration Program. I'm Brian DeShazer. With the passing of celebrated author and performer Quentin Crisp in November of 1999, the world lost one of its most visionary thinkers. In the 1920s, without the benefit of psychoanalysis, community centers, support groups, or self-help books, Quentin Crisp defied those who despised him for walking the streets of London looking, in his own words, undeniably like a homosexual person. His very existence, his survival, was his defiance. He was at the forefront of the struggle for gay and lesbian people simply to be. In short, he personified the line penned by Shakespeare, "To thine own self be true," and gave the ideals of civil disobedience and nonviolent protest new significance. The following program is a recording of the memorial service held in New York City, March 3, 2000, and explores the legacy of Mr. Crisp through the remembrances of his family and closest friends.
You can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York.
It was Quentin's lofty goal to meet everyone on Earth before he died. In a sense, friends were a hindrance to this ambition. "I like my friends," he would say, "but I adore strangers."
He was outrageous and wild and all over the place, but he just had these exquisite manners.
Take a look around the room for a second at each other, and isn't it amazing that we have one variety of everything here? It is amazing, all because of one man, and I think that's beautiful.
There's a wild rumor going around London that the Queen Mother died 17 days ago, but they put her on ice until August for her 100th birthday. And I thought, isn't that just the sort of gossip that you would love to tell Quentin Crisp?
He was a great and gentle man with probably the most focused identity of our time. He gave so tirelessly to everyone he could and left quite a hole in our universe with his passing.
The following three speakers are Quentin's nieces, Elaine Goicolea, Denise Pratt-Renner, and Frances Ramsey, giving insight into the family history and their relationship with their uncle, Quentin Crisp.
He was our uncle. He was cozy, delightful, warm, witty, enchanting. And he enriched our lives so much. In this world of compromises and keeping up with the Joneses and all that, he set a standard that we hope to try to follow in becoming better people, truer, more complete, less fragmented human beings. But I guess maybe we'll have to stop cleaning our houses if we're going to do that. Well, in a way, it seems so fitting that he went home to England to die, because although he loved New York, really loved New York, he was, and as he said in his own words, very quintessentially English. Thank you.
My name was, as you'll know if you read the book, my Christian name was Dennis in a time gone by.
My father, Louis, Quentin's elder brother, not elder brother, but 1 year older, I was his first child, and I could have been called Louise after my father, Louis, or Geraldine after his brother, Gerald. But I was named Denise after Dennis, Quentin. Even one of my grand nephews is called Quentin. Quentin's family loved, respected, and admired him. And I'm really impressed to see so many people who felt the same about him. Well, I didn't get to see him very often because I lived in, and I still do, lived in South America, but we wrote to each other very often. and his letters were obviously very witty, full of wisdom. But something that perhaps not many know, they were very warm and caring. He used to sign them Quentin, oh, sorry, Uncle Dennis. When he still lived in England and working as an artist's model, for instance, he wrote, "They don't really need models, but I have become a sort of status symbol, a naked Cadillac." After a short visit to New York, he advised me, "Now that I am back, I am writing all about it for the English papers and advising everyone to leave for America at once." Finally, when his dream came true and he came to live in New York, and I was going through some difficult circumstances, times, his letter to me read, "If you possibly can, you should come here, though I am aware of your difficulties. Everyone is rich, and everyone is handsome, so you could marry almost anybody within a week." But it was the caring behind the one-liners that touched me. When my husband, my first husband, whom he had never met, died suddenly in 1973, his caring and tenderness was one of the things that helped assuage my grief. Well, I'm about to become emotional, which I'm sure my very English Uncle Quentin would have abhorred, so I will leave it that way there and we'll miss him.
Well, as you've heard, Quentin was my uncle, my mother's youngest brother. There were four of them in the family. They were all witty, amusing, and eccentric in their own way, but he was the only one who managed to make a living out of it. I can never remember anything he said or did being questioned by the family. He was just accepted and appreciated for himself, even at a time when he was ridiculed by the world at large. When I asked as a child, "Why does Uncle Dennis wear makeup?" I was told by my grandmother, "Because he likes to." My grandmother, who is his mother, was an amazing woman, a legend in her own right, far ahead of her time. She and Quentin had a very special relationship. They would sit and entertain each other for hours on end. He used to say, "I'll go and talk to Mother, who knows the secrets of the world." He wrote to her regularly, and the highlight of the week was when his letters came recalling his life in London. We used to all fall about laughing, as he would say. Unfortunately, none of these letters were kept. He used to come and stay about once a year when, after listening to endless tales of his friends in London, we played innumerable games of cards and Scrabble, which he always won. He was generous to the last degree. At a time when he really had little or no money, he used to send his mother the odd £5 note saying he couldn't get any more notes under the mattress. To me, he was always as generous in life as in death, and I feel very humbled by this and quite undeserving. But his real legacy to me is the remembrance of him and his life and what it meant to me and to thousands of others. And I only hope some of his charisma, wit, compassion, and charm will be passed on through the generations. Thank you.
I have now been to various places, including New York, which I'm able to tell you, if you don't know, is just like heaven.
Performance artist Penny Arcade.
I met Quentin almost immediately when he came to the East Village, but I didn't really get to know him until the late 80s when Jack Eric Williams would bring him to all my shows. And I was stunned by Quentin when I finally did get to know him, because when I would just see him in the street, I thought, oh, that queen, you know. Well, I mean, I was raised by gay men, so, you know, I'm very dishy and judgmental. And when I did get to know him, I was stunned by his non-elitism, by his egalitarian spirit, that he was truly that person. And in 1993, for the last performance of Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore, he and Marianne Faithfull were in the show. And in the middle of the show, I asked Quentin if he would promise to live to be 100. And he said, yes, I promise I shall live to be 100, Miss Arcade. Shortly before that, he had named me as his anima figure. He called me up and he said, would it be all right with you if I name you as my soulmate for the London Sunday Telegraph? And I said, yes, and I was, of course, incredibly pleased and honored because, you know, I did know that Quentin and I shared a lot of things in common. There were all these different things that I thought we had in common that would make me his soulmate or his anima figure. Then I got mailed the page from the magazine. It was a Sunday magazine for the London Sunday Telegraph. And the quote from Quentin was, most people would be horrified to be publicly identified by me as their soulmate. But Miss Arcade is impervious to embarrassment. Somewhere in this time, Quentin came under a lot of fire from gay activists. At the time, I had a very aggressive attitude about gay politics because all my friends were dying. And by 1992, I had lost over 200 friends. And I often didn't understand Quentin's position on it. He would say, well, when I was young, syphilis was all the rage. And I did understand that, in fact, he was over 70, actually over 80 at that time. And I know that people stop changing when they're 25 or 30. So, I mean, to imagine somebody at his age, I would imagine that he had a position on things. And at that time, he said to me, because he would always say that gay people weren't real. And I had a problem with this. And he would say, well, if the opposite of gay is straight, then the opposite of straight is crooked. If the opposite of real is imaginary, I don't mind being an imaginary person, but I don't like being a crooked person. He called me up and he said, Miss Arcade, I know I've always promised you to live to be 100 years old, but I was wondering if you would give me a dispensation so that I only had to live to be 90. And I said, well, Quentin, okay, you can die at 90 if you want, but it's only 2 years from now. I said, you can't leave the planet until you debrief us on this horrible so-called postmodern era. And he said, well, what's postmodern? And I said, I don't know, I don't believe in it. And he said, I don't believe in it either. And I want to say that Quentin's great legacy is in his writing, and that everyone can have a personal relationship with Quentin through his writing. And I encourage you, if you haven't read him, to read him, because he was what we all want to be. He grew up to be himself. And that is the greatest thing that anyone can achieve.
I mean, modern science is so unkind that one might live to be 90.
Director of the Quentin Crisp Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, Louis Coelani.
I'm not bragging, but merely brimming with joy when I say that Quentin wrote of our friendship. I can think of no higher compliment than to be immortally linked with Quentin through his books. Two of my favorite heroes are Quentin Crisp and Shakespeare's King Henry V. An odd pairing, for Quentin was as gentle as Henry was warlike. Henry's cause was to conquer nations through force and violence. Quentin's cause was to educate his oppressors through the art of self-expression. Yet as different as they were, both of my heroes found themselves outnumbered and fought against the odds. In a famous speech from Shakespeare's play, King Henry rouses his army by invoking two early Christian martyrs. Their names were Crispin and Crispian, and they were brothers. I like to think that as a young man, Quentin, who was often beaten bloody in the city streets merely for being himself, borrowed his last name, Crisp, from these brothers, these two courageous men, whose brains were dashed out on the streets of ancient Rome because of their beliefs. And Crispin, Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. From this day to the ending of the world, Quentin lives on through us. And we few here tonight, we band of brothers and sisters, we carry on.
Everyone is fascinating who can be got to talk about himself. This is the thing. Nothing is boring except a lie. If you can get people really to tell you the truth about themselves, then they're all interesting. More than that, they're all fascinating. So that as far as I'm concerned, if I've hungered for success, it's because it will bring me to more people. As far as I'm concerned, that's all there is. To spread yourself out to the utmost limit before the largest number of people.
The following two speakers are Quentin's longtime friends, Mr. Evan Thompson and Mrs. Joan Thompson.
In the summer of 1982, our son, Owen Thompson, who regrets that he can't be here tonight, but he's in rehearsal, asked Mr. Crisp if he would play Lady Bracknell in a production of The Importance of Being Earnest. And when he stopped laughing, he very graciously said yes, which is how I came to have the honor of directing Mr. Crisp the first time he appeared on any stage as a character other than himself. Although, of course, it really was himself. And, of course, I didn't really direct him. I sort of said, well, you come over and sit there, and then you say it, and the others will move around you. And he did, magnificently, with the most incredible understanding of every nuance that Oscar Wilde had written, with the great wit, and with that underlying melancholy that was at the soul of all of Mr. Crisp's humor. And on one occasion, we were relaxing in the dressing room, and he said to me, you know, I could never really be an actor because I have no idea why any human being behaves as he does. But I do know where to put the semicolons.
Oh, well, not to cry. In that same production, I got myself appointed. I played Miss Prism to his Lady Bracknell, but I somehow got myself appointed as his dresser. And we were fond of each other even that long ago. I never called him anything but Mr. Crisp the entire 18 and a half years that I knew him well. And he never called me anything but Mrs. Thompson, except in that production, because the dresser, the movie of The Dresser, was at the time very current, and we both seen it and loved it. He called me Norman. And, of course, I called him Sir. And that was the only first name that he ever called me. And so, during that time when I was his dresser, he had a wig, which was created for him by the late lamented Ethel Eichelberger. And, right. In fact, Ethel called me and asked for the privilege of doing Mr. Crisp's wig, which he did for nothing and out of love, and it was a beautiful thing to do, and it was a great wig. But Mr. Crisp was uneasy wearing this wig over his own quite beautiful white hair. It wasn't really a necessary wig, but, you know. So over the wig, of course, he wore a variety of hats. In each scene he was in, he had a different hat, and they were all skewered to the wig by a very wickedly long and sharp hat pin. And it was my job, or I felt it was my job, to gingerly maneuver this hat pin through the wig, through the hat first and the wig, then out through the hat. And it made us both very, very uneasy. So one night, Mr. Crisp said, taking the hat pin from me in his very gentle fashion, he said, "Let me do that, because only I know where millinery ends and meningitis begins." He loved that story, and he would have me tell it at every opportunity. I don't think he ever told it himself. It wasn't in any book. Anyway, I just would like to end by saying to Mr. Crisp, "Hello, Mr. Crisp. This isn't Mrs. Norman Maine, but it is Norman, and good night."
Performance artist and impersonator Stephen Sorrentino.
I didn't realize how attached I was to Mr. Crisp. I got to live for a month with him. I got to survive for a month with him in Minneapolis when we filmed the movie Homo Heights. And I was a little embarrassed because in the movie I wore a dress, and Mr. Crisp and I always had a good relationship, and I was a regular Long Island kind of guy, and he was Mr. Crisp. And I put on the dress, and I said, "I'm a little embarrassed. What do you think?" And he looked close and said, "I think you look quite cozy." So we spent a month in heels together. It was incredible. I moved to Las Vegas, and I tried to get Mr. Crisp to come visit me on the West Coast, and I said, "You should come to Las Vegas. It's a fun place, and you could stay at my home, and we can have a wonderful time." And he says, "I don't know what to say to gamblers." And I said, "You can say anything." He said, "I went to Atlantic City once." Pardon me if I'm not doing a good impression. "I went to Atlantic City once with a strange man who gave me money, and I put the money in the machine, and I lost all the money. And then he gave me more, and I put more in, and then it all came out." "And I said, 'There.' And he made me put the money back in the machine." "I don't understand." I would just like to say from the bottom of my heart that when he was put in hospital for the first time, and I was a part of that, and I apologized till the last time we saw each other, for years, like Miss Arcade, I had to apologize. I brought to the hospital a beautiful robe with a big Q on it. And he said to me, "Why are you so kind to me?" And I thought, and I remember being a young man looking at the naked civil servant and saying, "I can be an individual. I could be myself, because if a man like that has that kind of courage, and if that courage exists in a human being, then I certainly could be myself, no matter what." And I said, "Mr. Crisp, without you, there would be no me." And he just smiled. So I think right now that there's a chair and a drink, a real drink, as he would say, up in heaven. And he's looking down, and he would hate all this fuss. But I think he would stop for a second and say just one word: "Lovely."
Anxiety is in the future, and regret is in the past, and betrayal is in other people. But in you, there is only yourself, there is only your happiness.
You are listening to the Quentin Crisp Memorial Celebration Program. Next we hear from dramatist Tim Fountain.
There was the obligatory lunch at Cafe 99, because I think the Cooper Diner was closed at the time. And he sat in the window and he received his meal free as recompense for sitting in the window. And he held forth for another 2 hours. Later, as we tottered home through the snow, I told him that he was contractually obliged to approve the script I was writing. In typical Quentin style, he said, "I accept whatever you write." And he did. I spoke to him a couple of weeks before he died, and I asked him if he'd received the play, and he said, "I've received it, but I haven't read it." He was far more interested in telling me about his hernia, which he said proudly was as big as an orange. Quentin never got to see the play, but I think he received word of what a big success it was. Night after night, an incredible cross-section of people, from Kensington ladies to Camden queens, sat rapt by his words and stories and Beck's portrayal of him. I think they marvelled at the sheer courage with which he lived his life. As Beck said in a tribute to him at the Royal Albert Hall, "Never forget that Quentin Crisp was out in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. He stayed out in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. And that's an incredible thing." When he passed away, some of the English press, and indeed some of the English gay press, tried to portray him as, to use Quentin's own phrase, a sad, lonely, embittered old queen. They were so wrong. I can't think of anyone who suffered as much and was less bitter or more generous with his time.
The only advantage of being an outsider to such an extent was that every day, just to live at all was a kind of triumph.
Quentin's former agent and editor of The Wit and Wisdom of Quentin Crisp, Guy Kettlehack.
Asked to suggest the remedy for a broken heart, Quentin replied, "The remedy is to learn not to value love because it is requited. If you have love to give, you give it, and you give it where it is needed. Once you have this idea in your head, the idea of a broken heart will disappear." Asked if he believed in God, well, in a conversation with someone he knew would not take offense, his answer was simply no. But in his response to the question at a performance he gave in New Orleans, he gave an answer which, when I have read it to various Jesuit, Buddhist, and Orthodox Jewish friends, has met with their instantaneous and awestruck agreement. It's the closest to a manifesto I've ever heard Quentin make. Here it is. "Do you believe in God?" "Well, now, the last time you know who was mentioned, I began by saying I wouldn't like to say anything that gave offense. And someone in the audience said, 'Why stop now?' But this is still something that worries me, so if at any moment anyone finds anything I say offensive, they have only to jump up and down, make a scene, and we will stop. I believe, like most people, not that of which logic can convince me, but what my nature inclines me to believe. This is so of nearly everybody. I am unable to believe in a God susceptible to prayer as petition. It does not seem to me to be sufficiently humble to imagine that whatever force keeps the planets turning in the heavens is going to stop what it's doing to give me a bicycle with 3 speeds. But if God is the universe that encloses the universe, or if God is the cell within the cell, or if God is the cause behind the cause, then this I accept absolutely. And if prayer is a way of aligning your body with the forces that flow through the universe, then prayer I accept. But there is a worrying aspect about the idea of God. Like witchcraft or the science of the zodiac or any of these other things, the burden is placed elsewhere. This is what I don't like. You see, to me, you are the heroes of this hour. I do not think the earth was ever meant to be your home. I do not see the sky as a canopy held over your head by cherubs or see the ground as a carpet laid at your feet. You used to live an easy lying down life in the sea, but your curiosity and your courage prompted you to lift your head out of the sea and gasp this fierce element in which we live. They are seated on Mars with their little green arms folded, saying, 'We can be reasonably certain there is no life on Earth, because there the atmosphere is oxygen, which is so harsh that it corrupts metal.' But you learned to breathe it. Furthermore, you crawled out of the sea and you walked up and down the beach for centuries, until your thigh bones were thick enough to walk on land. It was a mistake, but you did it. Once you have this view of your past, not that it was handed to you, but that you did it, then your view of the future will change. This terror you have of the atom bomb will pass. Something will arise which will breathe radiation if you learn to breathe oxygen. So you don't have to worry. Don't keep looking into the sky to see what is happening. Embrace the future. All you have to do about the future is what you did about the past. Rely on your curiosity and your courage and ride through the night.
Playwright and critic Eric Bentley.
About a little less than 20 years ago, Quentin acted for the first time in a real role outside himself in The Importance of Being Earnest, somewhere a few blocks from here, I remember. At the time he was performing that, he was rehearsing with me in another play, which became his second role. Importance of Being Earnest was by Oscar Wilde. My play was about Oscar Wilde. It was called Lord Arthur's Lover, and Quentin played the 75-year-old Lord Alfred Douglas in it. I want to read you the program note about Quentin, which, of course, he wrote himself from that time. Quentin Crisp, Lord Alfred Douglas, has seldom acted, though his detractors say that he has never done anything else. He has made brief, bewildered appearances in a few films, which it would be polite to call experimental, and more recently attempted to perform the part of Lady Bracknell in The Importance of Being Earnest in an airless back room on Mercer Street. His inclusion in the cast of the present play is the whim of the professor. That was what he always called me. I was one of the few that wasn't Mr. I was always the professor. His inclusion in the cast of the present play is the whim of the professor, who will be held entirely responsible for any disgrace that is hereby brought upon the history of the American theater. Well, I think the show is remembered by a few people, but I know that it's remembered chiefly for Quentin's presence in it. He was on stage all evening because Lord Alfred told the whole story. And I just want to share one thought with you that I never got a chance to share with him about the whole occasion. I was not only the author, I was the director, and I cast him in the play for what turned out to be a foolish reason. But my reason for casting him in the play, which some of you who know the background of Quentin in New York will follow easily enough, was that I was part of the gay movement, which is extremely opposed to Quentin's ideas on a number of things. Particularly, we thought he had wrong ideas about homosexuality in general. And Quentin was telling us he didn't approve of sex, or he didn't like sex anymore, and he wasn't going to have it anymore. And we were quarreling with him about this. I cast him as Old Lord Alfred because Old Lord Alfred was a very unpleasant character who had the wrong attitude to homosexuality. That was why I offered Quentin the role. I'm sure that wasn't why he accepted it. However, I'm telling you the story because in the end, although it may not be a nice story about me, it's a nice story about him. Because working with him, and of course to do that, I had to be seeing him every day for about 6 weeks of rehearsal and several weeks of performance, he completely changed my mind about who he was, what he stood for, what he was like, and how I should relate to him. It was all completely different. I realized that his statement, for instance, that gay is abnormal, was based on a considerable disrespect for normality. As to sex, you know, of course, I'm 83 and therefore have an old man's bias on these things. In the gay movement, particularly back then in the 70s, I'm talking about 1980 at the moment, but back then, 60s, 70s and on, and Quentin, and we'd all lived through that, we all thought in the gay movement sex was a good thing. It was not only a good thing, it was almost the only thing. Our outlook was, I'm speaking only of the males now, our outlook was completely phallocentric, and we just thought the more sex the better, and Quentin didn't agree. We thought he was crazy or puritanical. And I think with the passage of years, perhaps it's not wholly because I'm so old myself, that we realize now that a lot of our ideas were wrong. There was a tremendous exaggeration of the importance of sex of any kind. You know, we had, after a book came out called The Joy of Sex, there had to be a book called The Joy of Gay Sex, which the aim, in a sense, was to show the joy of gay sex was presumably greater. But there was no kind of human and balanced understanding of sex. Quentin had that. I learned some of it from him. I just wanted to say that appreciative note, adding to what my colleagues have been saying, I think, along the same line. Thank you very much.
When you have your style, you lay it at the feet of your neighbor. You don't get better than them. You don't put your style across other people. You offer it to them. It is not a question of getting the better of other people. It is not a question of being more peculiar than other people. When I was in Woking, a man said, "All you want us to do is wear funny clothes." "I want you to wear funny clothes if you're funny people."
Well, I'm Sylvia Miles, but to Quentin, I was always Miss Miles. Now it's a party. Miss Miles is here. And very often, Quentin and I would sit on a couch, totally ignored by everybody, looking smashing, me with my leopard hat or my leopard gloves, and he with his extraordinary chic look, bon vivant, scarf, everything. And we would look at each other and laugh because nobody cared that we were sitting there, except they did want to know that we were there. Do you know what I mean? So that was sort of like a little joke we had, you know. I think for a while we kept being invited to all the same things, and hopefully they would think we would come alone and sit with each other so that we were sort of the oddballs there. Anyway, I was at an opening night of Love and Death in Long Island, which starred John Hurt, and Quentin and I were sitting together at the reception afterwards, which was in the Merck Bar, or the Mercer Bar, something like that. And I got up to go to the ladies' room, and I ran into John Hurt. And I said, "You know, I'm sitting with Quentin Crisp. Do you want to say hello?" Thinking, of course, that they knew each other very well, he having played in The Naked Civil Servant. And he said, "Oh, I'd really like to meet him." It turned out they had never met, and I introduced them, which I thought was rather amazing in this world. So I loved Quentin. He was truly a gentleman. He was gallant. He was brave. He was everything that you would ever want a man to be, as long as you made sure that he got home and that you either escorted him there or got somebody to take him home. Other than that, he was perhaps the kindest and gentlest man that I've known in New York. I will miss him greatly. And he's also the only person to ever always called me Miss Miles. So I always felt very grand when I was with him. It was wonderful meeting and hearing his family tonight, because I think that all of you possess a really wonderfully unique English quality that is so endearing to Americans, particularly if you are if you are Anglophiles, as I am. It's brave and it's different. It's eccentric and wonderful, and only the British people really appreciate that. We don't really appreciate that here as we should. I mean, generally speaking, Americans. So it was wonderful meeting you and knowing that Quentin had such a wonderful family, because one felt when they knew him that he really was a solitary figure without this. So now I know that he was in the tradition of his family.
American composer and writer Ned Rorem.
Since brevity is next to godliness, a premise that Quentin would have respected, I will speak for 1 minute. I knew him before I knew him, having blurbed The Naked Civil Servant prior to his immigration here. Then I saw his one-man show, then read his other writing. Finally, we met through, I think, Tom Steele, and though we often did not see eye to eye, for example, before he learned I was a composer, he dispensed with the whole profession by saying the already quoted, "Music is a mistake." We remained staunch acquaintances until the end. I very much admired, in our age of increasing international vulgarity, the fact that Quentin Crisp referred even to his closest friends as Mr. and Miss, and sometimes even Mrs. This may have sounded cute on the surface, but it promoted a sense of distancing formal elegance that is the essence of mutual respect, something that is more important than love. Quentin was arguably a sort of marginal creature, or pariah even, but so by definition is every artist. He had a sense of social decency in a world where such formality is increasingly collapsing. No one was remotely like Quentin, with his extreme politeness, his unbitchy wit, and his basic common sense in the form of aphorism. With his death, the world weighs less.
Why do you consider it to be more fulfilling to be recognized for yourself rather than what you create? Because if it's for what you create, what good it will do you? You will be standing in a room at a party and someone will say, "Who's that over there?" And the reply will be, "Apparently he's a famous sculptor." What good is this? And people are always saying to me, perhaps people want their work to be recognized after their death. What good is that?
Author and publisher, Professor Richard Connolly.
During the 1980s, I had occasion to meet Elaine Stritch and told Elaine Stritch that I had been doing some work with Quentin. And she told me a story which I'd like to share with you. When Elaine was in one of her most successful periods in London during the show Two's Company, she suffered a very severe attack of diabetes and went into a semi-coma. And she was in a hospital in London. And she came out of the coma, and there was a woman there, an aide in the room, and asked Elaine whether she wanted anything in particular to help her feel better that day. And in Elaine's voice, if you know it, it was a kind of raspy voice, "Yeah, you can get me Quentin Crisp here." And the woman happened to know Quentin, and within a half an hour, he was there. And a tale of connection and synchronicity began, which led to a bit of information that I cherish as an insight into both Elaine Stritch and Quentin Crisp. I met Quentin and told him the story of that meeting with Elaine. He said, "Oh yes, Miss Stritch. She taught me something very important. We were talking about what it meant to be an entertainer. And we talked back and forth, and Elaine told me, don't think about any of those things, Quentin. Just get them to like you." Years later, Quentin and I talked a bit about that, and he told the story again, as he often did, sometimes with slightly different endings, but with the same emphasis on certain words. And he repeated the story, and he turned to me and he said, "But I took it a step further, Professor Connolly. I got them to feel sorry for me." In the last year and a half of Quentin's life, I had occasion to play with that comment of his back and forth and to suggest to him that somehow I didn't feel that. I didn't feel that feeling sorry for him, and we played with that back and forth in our conversations. And I use the word conversation because it's something that at the end of Quentin's life, we found ourselves having conversations. He often said that he was always just being interviewed. But I found that he was asking me questions, and I would often say to him, "Careful, careful, this could be the beginning of a conversation."
Actor John Hurt.
Quentin Crisp once paid me the grand pontifical compliment that I was his representative here on Earth. This was a compliment in regard to my having played him in the filmed version of his autobiography, The Naked Civil Servant. adapted by the late wise Philip Mackey and directed by the very much alive and brilliant Jack Gold. At the time of filming Civil Servant, Quentin was untraveled and 68 years old. He referred to the latter part of his expected life as the twilight of my life. I suggested that rather than twilight, sunset would be a more accurate description. He lived to be 90, and the soft light of the sunset enriched the lives of many people. When I first met Quentin, he declared, "I don't believe in abroad. I think people speak English behind our backs." After the success of Servant, Quentin was invited to New York. So, from Chelsea, London, to the Chelsea Hotel, New York, where, on entering, he declaimed, "Home." If Quentin ever harbored a regret in his life, it was that he had not found New York earlier. Jack, Philip, and myself pledged ourselves to making The Naked Civil Servant in 1970. And I will not go into the dark ages of the next 4 years, fraught with rejection, before we went into production in 1974. Helped by the vision of Verity Lambert and Jeremy Isaacs of Thames Television, the film was made. I was told by many important people that if I were to make this film, I would never work again. How many times do we have to listen to that ludicrous threat? It was an extraordinary piece about an extraordinary man. A man born into seeming impossibility. Not uncared for, but equally not understood. Here was a boy of charm and intellect, an enchanted creature that had no apparent place upon this earth. Where would he roam? His life has answered that question. He never wavered from his crusade. Listen, he always did. Respect, he always had. Love from his generous heart, he always offered.
Quentin's editor at HarperCollins Publishing, Larry Ashmead.
I worked with Quentin and Guy on The Wit and Wisdom of Quentin Crisp in 1984, and for the next 16 years we remained casual friends. As you know, he had a wonderful theory about stars, particularly whether they had style and glamour. He felt some had one or the other, and very few had both, and most had neither, and he was very adamant about that. There was one star who fascinated Quentin, and that was Ethel Merman. I had published Merman's autobiography in 1978, and Quentin loved to hear my stories about working with Merman. For instance, she was a former secretary, and she typed the entire manuscript herself with two carbons. In the book, we had to put in the quickest way to get to LaGuardia Airport from Manhattan, which went right past her ancestral home in Astoria, Queens. Quentin ate these stories up. He absolutely loved them. But for one reason or another, I was never able to get the two of them together. Quentin wasn't exactly Ethel Merman's type of guy. But there was one rather offbeat occasion that came up, and Merman and Crisp did meet. First, some background. Somehow, Ethel Merman got it in her head that she should do difficult crossword puzzles. It's something she read in one of those magazines, and they said it was a very stylish pursuit. She loved that phrase, a stylish pursuit. Every Sunday, she would get the New York Times, she would turn to the crossword puzzle page and sit there. Now, Ethel Merman could type 82 words a minute. She could learn a lyric to a song in 2 minutes, either Cole Porter or Irving Berlin. And she sang perfect pitch without any vocal training at all. But believe me, she was not much of a wordsmith. So every Sunday, she would call a mutual friend we had named Morty. And she'd say, "Hey, I got 3 words. Let's do the rest of the puzzle together." They would, And then Ethel would call up her best friend, B'nai Venuta, and help her with the puzzle. B'nai Venuta thought Ethel was an absolute word genius. And they agreed that doing the crossword puzzles was indeed a stylish pursuit. Well, our friend Morty died. And when the memorial service was scheduled, Ethel insisted on singing a song for Morty. I invited Quentin to come with me, and he gladly accepted. As you know, he would attend almost any event. Even in the opening of a closet door was enough. And a memorial service for someone he didn't know was more than enough. So here's the picture. It's a small little chapel on the Upper East Side. Up front on one side was Morty's family. I think they were from Missouri. They were very square and very solemn, very conservative. On the other side were the speakers with eulogies ready, and of course, Ethel Merman. And she got up first. She marched to the podium and announced in her inimitable voice of brassy and bell, she said, "This is a song for Mary." That's what I always called him. Quentin whispered to me, "It's going to get better." And then she launched into the song, full voice. The way she combed her hair, the way she danced till three, they can't take that away from me. Quentin, who always had that cool facade and never showed much emotion, was absolutely beside himself with mirth. After the service, I introduced Ethel and Quentin. Quentin complimented Miss Merman on her a cappella rendition of "They Can't Take That Away From Me." And Merman managed a reasonable, kind remark about Quentin's hair, which she called cerise. And that out of the blue, she said, "Hey, do you do crossword puzzles?" I wanted to warn Quentin that if he said yes, he could be in for a long phone call every Sunday for the rest of his life. But he responded quickly, "Miss Merman, I don't read books, and I certainly don't do crossword puzzles." Merman said, "You should, you know. It's a very stylish pursuit." Well, Quentin, crossword puzzles didn't count much for your life, but you certainly followed a lot of very stylish pursuits. And by the way, we love the way you combed your hair. Thank you.
You see, the ideal thing would be to have 365 friends and see each of them once a year.
Philip asked me to read one of the last pieces that Quentin was writing, and it's called What Does It Mean to Be Human? When Professor Connolly asked me what it meant to be human, I was very sorry that I was not a scholar and had no physiological point of view to express. More than not being a scholar, I am not really a human being. I do not mind spending long hours alone, and I never find something to do. This is part of my nature. My sister reminded me before she died that she and my mother sat on each side of the fireplace and occupied themselves with darning socks and knitting and writing letters on their laps. I lay as a child on the rug between them, and once an hour one of them would say, "Why don't you get something to do?" And I said, "Why should I?" That is a question I cannot answer. Why should I have something to do? Of course, this is a theory that time is money. It is an American theory. I am not earning money while I'm not doing anything, which is sad. But if I were rich, I would never do anything. I was asked by a paper, "If you suddenly had $1 million, what would you do?" And I said, "Go to bed and never get up again." This was a great disappointment to the people who asked me that question. But idleness is my only occupation, and people are my only hobby. If I regard what I think is human, and perhaps I was asked precisely because I am not a human being, and therefore have attached a detached view of the subject, I would say it was a preoccupation with the idea of death. The reason why people do not live alone and do not spend hours doing nothing is because they can hear time ticking by. Then they develop hobbies which drive them mad. You may ask them, "Why do you do this?" They ultimately say, "Well, it kills time." I don't want my time dead. Time is to be lived. Those who are not hopeless are worried that one day their lives will end. And if you live long enough, of course, you long for it to end. That's been my desire in recent times. I only hope to become extinct. But before all that, you must try everything. Have children. Behave in such a way that monuments are built to you. Rule the world. Have streets and theaters named after you. Write your autobiography. These are ways to stay alive. And this seems to be the preoccupation with the human being. When I was younger and was not ill, I didn't mind how long I lived. Now that every step of my life is painful, I long for death. If being human has any other special aspect, it is that in every human being, there are two people. One who sits in judgment on the other. The worldly, the doing person, acts irresponsibly, or nobly, or wisely, or foolishly, according to the mood or the situation. But inside him, further away, is an abstract spiritual being who never changes and who sits in judgment on him. This situation becomes evident when you hear people say, "I was ashamed of myself." Who is ashamed of whom? It is this duality between the active living organism and the contemplative inner self that sits in judgment that constitutes the whole human being. This is, I think, what constitutes a human being.
That was What Does It Mean to Be Human? From the yet-to-be-released book of Quentin's writings entitled Dusty Answers, read by Quentin's traveling companion Chip Snell.
To conclude anything about Quentin, one would have to go to that which is essential, the essence of Quentin. He was a philosopher, and he is the only philosopher, to my knowledge, that actually lived his philosophy. He was a major, major figure of the 20th century, and he wasn't like anyone. He was literally unique.
All my life is given to the world. I don't have a life, I have very few hours in which I'm doing anything except sleeping or being with the world. Now this I like. I've done it myself, and this is a life that I live.
You have been listening to highlights from the memorial service honoring visionary thinker Quentin Crisp. Thanks to Philip Ward, estate executor and organizer of the Quentin Crisp Foundation, www.crisperanto.org. John Hurt's tape courtesy of Professor Richard Connolly. Additional music composed by Evan Lurie for the film Homo Heights, which co-starred Mr. Crisp. This program is presented by the Pacifica Radio Archives, producer Brian DeShazer, co-producer and technical director Mark Torres. For copies of this program, call Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230.